This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
What happens in a relationship packed with passion, alcohol, and alleged personality disorders, and it collides with the old boys club of Massachusetts law enforcement. In this episode, we're going to be diving into day one of the Karen Reed retrial and a bit into day two and where this is all going, where prosecutors say she drunkenly backed over her Boston cop boyfriend after a fight, or now the story is more so she clipped him, I guess. The defense says, hold up, there's a scapegoat going on here for a full house of cops who know really what happened. We got paramedics, shattered taillights, Dateline confessions, but we also have inconsistencies, allegations of police cover-ups, and just enough circumstantial confusion to make your head spin. Joining us is psychotherapist and author Siobhan Scott, who specializes in the psychology of criminal behavior, narcissism, emotional manipulation. Siobhan, when you look at this case, do you see the mind of a woman who might have blacked out and made a fatal mistake, or the psyche of someone gaslit into believing she didn't do something that maybe she did do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those cases that is so convoluted and confusing. But we know by how much alcohol she had had that night that very likely, at best, she had memory impairment. At worst, which I think is more likely, she has no actual recollection. And so she's trying to fill in the blanks with guesses at this point. And of course, she's guessing for something that means she didn't do anything wrong. But clearly, early on, she wasn't sure.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing they dropped in the courtroom in the opening statements just the other day, I found it interesting, was the Dennis Murphy interview on Dateline. I'll play it back here real quick, and I want to get your reaction. This is an early interview with Karen before the first trial even started. And it's so interesting how her confidence in this interview, her convictions in this interview are now the exact opposite of what she seems to be saying. At least sometimes it seems to be. Let's take a look at all of this.
I said, could I have hit him? Did I hit him?
How could that have been? I mean, you dropped him off at the house.
I don't know what else could have been. It was howling wind. I had YouTube blasting on the stereo. And I thought, did he somehow try to flag me down, which was the reaction I was hoping to garner as I slowly pulled away from the house? Did he come out and maybe trip or bend over to pick up his cell phone and I ran over his foot and then he passed out drunk? I mean, I didn't think I hit him, but could I have clipped him? Could I have tagged him in the knee and incapacitated him?
So all these things are going through her head. I mean, and when she's speaking about this, and she also spoke like this in the newer documentary as well, when she was speculating, and it seemed still like she was kind of wondering, you know, could this have happened? But you go from that, and this is just paused right now. This is the key part of the interview and the key statement where she goes from speculation to this statement. Let's take a look.
He didn't look mortally wounded as far as I could see, but could I have done something that knocked him out and in drunkenness and in the cold didn't come to again?
And this would have been the moment you dropped him off at the party.
Yeah.
He didn't look mortally wounded. That's the weird part to me. What, you know, from my perspective, and I look at this, it's like, ooh, was that kind of a Freudian slip there? You kind of went from did I to a factual statement of observation and then back to speculation. What did you see in that moment?
It's damning. And she has so much emotion when she's talking about it. It's like, this is something that she's really trying to figure out. And it seems to be very legitimate for somebody that really doesn't know what happened. And she's thinking of possibilities and options. And, you know, clearly the prosecution is going to use this at this point.
Yeah, it certainly seems bizarre to go from that to this. Could I have clipped him? Prosecution is suggesting that's a consciousness of guilt, obviously. Could be consistent with, you know, obsessive, you know, rumination or a need to make sense of a traumatic memory, I guess. But it, I don't know. It's just it's a weird moment that she seems to have. Do you to be able to go down this road that she's gone down of if did I all of that to there's no way I could have hit him, which is kind of their stance right now. No way, not possible. How does one get there? I guess how does one go from that to that where. She starts, I guess, believing the story, the story of him getting beat up. Is that like a, you know, is that a trying to get out of jail free type deal? And she's just thinking of herself? Or do you think she really believes that that took place? And it's, you know, it's not just fodder for trying to get the attention off of her.
Yeah, as I understand the story now, she actually saw him enter the house.
Yeah.
And that's completely opposite of what her original story was. Mm-hmm. So my guess is she has convinced herself of the story that's going to keep her out of prison. She does not want to believe that she hit him in mm-hmm. any way. She doesn't want to believe she was responsible. And so here's a different story. And she has people around her, a legal team, a good percentage of the community who are going along with this new story. And people have the capacity to tell themselves a story until they start to believe it. So I think on a deep level, she really doesn't know, but mm-hmm. this is what she's latched onto.
It kind of reminds me of like a couple that is getting divorced, where both of them initially they're like, yeah, this isn't working. It's civil. And they're thinking, okay, yeah, let's work this out. Let's be fair to one another. And everybody's on the same page at the beginning. And then she goes to her girlfriends or he goes to his guy friends, whatever side you want to take it from. And they're like, you deserve more than that. Damn, she's, you know, he's an asshole. And then suddenly it goes from civil to peer pressure of I'm going to destroy you. And there's nothing that's going to stop me because suddenly I'm empowered by all of these people, peer pressure, that's telling me something that's worse than reality actually is. And, you know, everything that we had, everything to keep this sane and not go off the rails is gone. We're going to go down this crazy road. And had those conversations not happened with the friends, you know, it probably could be pretty civil and could have made sense, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. because of those outside influences, it goes way off the rails. That's mm-hmm. what this kind of feels like is she's ended up being surrounded herself with people that reinforced another narrative that completely is different from reality. And she went with it because it felt good. And that was what she really wanted to go for rather than what reality might have simply been.
You nailed it. I think that's a perfect analogy. Going with what feels good is a very common human problem. You know, people like things that make them look good. And when you have people around you giving that story, people can convince themselves that, okay, this is what reality is and I'm going with it.
Yeah, I mean, It's interesting what people are able to do. How do you assess someone with the risk of false memory or a confession when someone is intoxicated or panicking? Because she was running around that morning. I know they now say she didn't say I hit him. It's like, well, she clearly did. She still says it in interviews. I mean, she mm-hmm. still says every variation of it.
Yeah.
How much can you blame alcohol for her making those assumptions and saying those things out loud? And is that just the alcohol speaking? Or, you know, a lot of people go and say, well, you know, when you've been drinking, you tend to get a little more honest about what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to assess, you know. if we don't know exactly what someone's blood alcohol was at the time, you know, we're just going basing upon how much did they have to drink, what's mm-hmm. their body weight, how quickly did they consume alcohol, and I think in this case, what was it, 9 drinks in just a few hours, and she's a really tiny woman. Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say that her perceptions were significantly impaired, if not pretty much utterly impaired. And so her emotional reaction the next day and when she found his body, she could have still been under the influence of alcohol. And so who knows what was coming out of her mouth and what reality was.
Let's talk about the optics of this trial and what has been created outside of the courtroom. The rabid people on, I'll say, both sides to a certain extent, that, you know, they're there, they're fighting for someone. Sometimes they don't even know them. Sometimes they're coming from other states, other countries to support Karen Reed. That seems to be what we've seen a lot of. And going to very extremes to show that support, harassing witnesses, trying to intimidate them, trying to push their narrative, you know, no matter what. It's been spooky. You have people, there are people in this trial or not in this trial who refuse to testify because they're intimidated. They don't want to be part of this. They don't want to go say what their account of the day was, because if they do, and it goes against what narrative Karen has, you got the flying monkeys that are going to go mm-hmm. after her. Is mm-hmm. this going to become, you think, the new reality of a lot of cases where it's this side or that side and nobody is looking at the middle other than us?
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we try.
Yeah, and because reality seems to be much more in the middle of these cases, but people like a group, people like a tribe.
They
want to belong to something. And it seems, you know, there's obviously huge obsessions. People, for whatever reason, really enjoy true crime, even if it's not part of their lives, and find some sort of, you know, group comfort in that. What is going on here? We didn't see this in a lot of other trials, unless it's like Michael Jackson or somebody really big, OJ, that mm-hmm. was well known. Karen is nobody, mm-hmm. but somehow she's become somebody because of this case and because of the vitriol that goes on around this. How did this come to be the way it is? What was going on in the psyche of all of these people that allowed them to go from otherwise fairly normal folks to now camping out in front of a court in mm-hmm. every day mm-hmm. And the rest of their life be damned? What is happening mm-hmm. here?
It's I think, largely fueled by the power of the internet. Again, Karen is an attractive woman. She's appealing. And once it starts going viral online, people like to divide up into two camps. I mean, my God, we see this with our political system and the polarization. There's no ability to meet in the middle and be reasonable and try to look at, you know, data and evidence and talk things through and try to come up with something that's, you know, mm-hmm. probably plausible. People like to take sides, and they find this sense of identity and camaraderie with, yay, yay, our team. It's just like it's a sports team.
Yeah.
And it's pretty emotionally driven. It's not very logical, but it's definitely, I don't think, helpful in this case. I think it muddies the waters, and then you end up with witnesses being intimidated and attacked and, you know, really awful behavior.
Is that just a product of our times and the way that we develop now, essentially? I mean, we've never been in a world where we have what we have. We have generations now that, you know, we've had social media for quite some time, and you go through different phases of life and different years where, you know, your opinion is forming this way or that way. And I'm not just talking childhood. I'm talking 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever. Sure. Anybody who, you know, things change, opinions change, people change. But is it because we're in such an insular society now, even though we're able to communicate far wider and reacher than we ever have in the past, but we've seemed to become far more ingrained in our little groups than yes. we have in the past, that this is happening? It's not just for your college sports team anymore or your mm-hmm. NFL team or whatever. It's things mm-hmm. like this mm-hmm. that people are finding those sort of communities. And is it because there's no, it's just a loop? It's just a feedback loop? You aren't out there having, people are not having face-to-face conversations with people that matter to them. They're hearing it from mm-hmm. strangers and they're getting weight on it and thinking mm-hmm. that it really matters. Where in the past, you could talk to your friends and you could hear a differing opinion mm-hmm. and it made you think a little bit. You go, oh, mm-hmm. you know, okay. Mm-hmm. Is that what's going on? Is that why we're able, why things like this are getting the attention they're getting with such vitriol than we had in the past? And there's not a lot of introspection of any of these things?
Yeah, I think people find their echo chambers online. And when you go into one, you know, let's say YouTube community, one blogging community, and you find the same kind of people saying the same thing over and over and over again, it normalizes that story for you. And then it becomes everybody who doesn't buy into our story. It's that us and them dynamic. And rather than anybody trying to say, let's have a reasonable conversation and look at all the sides here, it's the echo chamber that people find online, I think, that just fuels this and makes it take off into something that's kind of ugly.
You know, we talked about delusional disorder when we were talking about Daybell. Is this kind of like that? Because you can hear from these people, I hear from them all the time, on both sides of this case specifically. And I'm kind of in the middle of all of this, where like I can see arguments on this side, I can see mm-hmm. arguments on that side. I don't think either side really makes a ton of sense. I think it's somewhere in the middle where we don't really know the true answers. I don't think anyone will ever really know the true answers. But a lot of people don't even want to see that. They don't want to look at mm-hmm. it from, because it's not as exciting. It's not mm-hmm. as, you know, sexy. And you can't quite get behind something that doesn't have the excitement that it's been presenting to you, because reality is usually a little bit more in the middle, a little more muted. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what my question is on this, but it's just a weird way of looking at things where balance seems to be out the window, but each side views themselves as being the balanced one.
Exactly.
Is that a version of delusion where you can't see anything beyond the trees? I mean, just like Lori Vallow kind of did?
It's a really good question. It's not delusional disorder because it's not strange. Mm-hmm. Either side, as you say, there are plausible aspects to it. Is it possible that there was a fight and you know, John was murdered? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's not bizarre. Now, if you said an alien came down and did it, that would be more in the realm of a delusion. Mm-hmm. And it's also quite possible that Karen was so intoxicated, she clipped him and has no memory of it. That's plausible. That's possible too. Is it, you know, one of the speculations was because she was angry at him, did she intentionally run into him with her car? That's possible. So I wouldn't say it's delusional. But it's more just this, you know, we've got a story and we're sticking to it. And it's like this us versus them now. And we want our side to win.
Does delusional disorder have to involve something that's, for lack of a better term, paranormal? Something like an alien, something like a ghost or God's talking to me or whatever it may be. Does it have to go down that road?
It's something that I think any reasonable person would look at and say, that can't be true. Mm-hmm. That can't be true. You know, the Catholic hospital euthanizing a bunch sure. of people and getting away with that for decades. Okay, that's just in the bizarre category. Mm-hmm. So it's something that any of us would look at and go, no, that's wacky.
But what about this? Because there's elements of this where you go, okay, you know, evidence could be planted. I know the independent review found no evidence of it, et cetera, et cetera. They found out that it wasn't the best investigation, and that's clearly obvious. But the concept here that you have countless people, a lot of people, kids, mm-hmm. Everybody being in on this conspiracy, and they're planning it on the fly, too. It's not like they're sitting there for weeks going, okay, John's going to come in, we're going to beat him up, and we're going to all have this story, and
Nobody's going to break. Nobody's going to crack. And we're all going to follow through it with it, you know, till the end of time. Number one, conspiracies don't work a lot of times because there's too many people involved and somebody's going to crack. Somebody's going to slip something up. This story of the house and getting beat up and everybody still following and towing the line seems ridiculous, I think, to a lot of people. I'm not to say that there wasn't crooked cops here and that there wasn't weight being put on the scale to try and go after Karen Reed heavier than they needed to. I think that that's going on. But this concept of all of these people being involved in this conspiracy and nobody's going to say anything different, that goes beyond. It was to be the best conspiracy in the world, if in fact it is true. That seems to be a bit out there. I mean, not to the level of aliens are coming down and struck John, but to have all of these things work out this perfectly and it was planned on the fly, what is that?
Yeah, conspiracy thinking. We see so much conspiracy thinking, and it's not grounded. You know, you can look at it and say this really isn't grounded in reality, but could it feasibly have happened? Sure, could have. We've heard weird stories before. Again, just going to politics, weird things happen, and it's kind of hard to believe and wrap our heads around. It's like, who would think of something so stupid, you know? But the conspiracy mindset, it does give people this sense of, well, we've got this special information, we know the truth, and so that's kind of ego boosting for them. And then we're in the club with all the cool kids who know what's really going on here. So it's kind of emotional thinking rather than logic.
And in this case, they really kind of set it up to make the conspiracy somewhat believable. I mean, there's so many weird aspects of this case that are shady on the part of the officers.
100%.
I mean, take, for example, everybody's getting rid of their phones at the same time. And they're not trading them in. I mean, the iPhones are worth money. Doesn't matter how old it is. Everybody knows this. You trade it in, you get some money back, you save some money, whatever. Maybe get your phone for free. They're throwing them in dumpsters. One of them's on an army base, chucking his phone and destroying the SIM cards and all of that stuff. Like, what is that? I mean, were they that oblivious to thinking that, hey, if this gets investigated, and even though they knew it was being investigated, that no one's going to look at this and go, that looks a little conspiratorial. That looks like you're trying to hide something.
Exactly.
Is that just idiots out there not thinking one step ahead of anything? Or I mean, that to me blows my mind of just if they didn't beat them up in the house, and I don't think they did. Why would you do these things that make you look like what people are going to be accusing you of is true? That to me has blown my mind on this case.
Yeah, it's another weird aspect to why we can say, okay, well, there is something that looks fishy there. And of course, Detective Proctor's horrendous behavior. Yeah. I mean, it looks like they were out to get her, you know, from the beginning. And it's just one of these really messy, awful cases that we'll probably never really know exactly what happened.
Obviously, we're going to be talking about this case and its developments over the next few weeks as it continues forward. But early on, with what we know right now, the direction that we can kind of see this going, where do you think it's going to end up? Are we going to get a guilty verdict? Are we going to get kind of a mixed on some of the charges? Are we going to get, you know, completely exonerated? Or are we going to get another hung jury at the end of the day? What's your guess?
Oh, I tell you, that's I can't even call it, because I certainly couldn't vote guilty. That's all I'll say is I just don't think we have enough information to something happened. There were a lot of drunk people, and we'll never know exactly, but could I convict her beyond a reasonable doubt? I could not.
On any of the charges, even manslaughter?
I don't think I could. Just because we just don't. I would need a lot more evidence than what I've seen.
I agree. I don't think you have. I think there's enough reasonable doubt on every single charge that you just can't prove it. I think it's likely that she probably hit him, but I don't think you can prove it. And at the end of the day, it's not about likely. It's about, is there reasonable doubt? Can you prove this? And it's not that I believe the conspiracy, but I just don't think there's the evidence. And that's,
you and I think alike on that.
We'll see where it ends.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.